There was this Irish brain surgeon. Pause for laughter. British music hall routine. By the time he neared St. Louis, Missouri, on his third day on the road, John had decided on the name under which he would first conceal himself. There would be other name changes required later, he realized, but a new one was needed immediately. It was early afternoon, and already there was color in the deciduous trees along the highway. The hills were brown, and a nip could be felt in the air. The cornfields were a rubble of cut and broken stalks. Billboards advertised winterizing. There would be a worldwide hunt for John Roe O'Neill before long. That name had to be abandoned, he thought. McCarthy. That had been his mother's name, and it felt comfortable. Someone might make the connection, but he would have abandoned it by then. His first name, that he felt he would have to keep. Too late to learn to answer to anything other than John. John McCarthy, then. And to give it the proper Irish-American flavor, John Leo Patrick McCarthy. He entered the city and was enclosed by its living movement without much noticing. His awareness was goal-oriented. Ordinary lodging. A Central District motel rented him a room, and he still had time to lease a large safety deposit box in a nearby bank. The money went into this box, and he breathed easier when he emerged onto the street, which was busy with its evening foot traffic. As he drove out of the parking lot, he glanced at his wristwatch. 4:55 p.m. Still plenty of time to take those first steps on the identity change. A newspaper classified advertisement led him to a rental room in a private suburban home. The landlady, Mrs. Pradowski, reminded him of Mrs. Neary. The same heavily weighted and cost-accounting watchfulness in her manner and behind the eyes. It was too soon to become John McCarthy. He had to leave a few footprints for the bloodhounds to follow. He showed Mrs. Pradowski his O'Neill driver's license and said he was looking for a teaching post. Mrs. Pradowski said he could have the room tomorrow morning. She gave no sign that she recognized his name from the news stories, now months old. The Grafton Street bombing was, after all, many tragedies back in time, and far distant from St. Louis. Her conversation revealed a primary interest in advance payment of rent and non-interference with her bingo nights. Now, to find out if the choice of St. Louis was correct. A pharmacy customer had warned him the previous winter, they got a regular factory there making phony ID papers. You gotta watch it when you're cashing checks. It took him 6 days and uncounted glasses of beer in seedy bars to make contact with the factory. 8 days later, he paid $5,000 and received a Michigan driver's license and assorted membership and identification cards in the name of John Leo Patrick McCarthy. Another $3,500 got him an intensive lesson in altering passports, plus a kit for making the alterations. "You got a real talent for this," his instructor said. "Just don't set up shop in my territory." Next, there was the problem of the car. Honest Andrew's previously owned cars on Auto Row gave him $2,200 cash. The dealer sighing, "Boy, them big cars don't move too fast anymore." The next morning he took a bus to Marion and bought a used Dodge Power Wagon. It was one of Mrs. Pradowski's bingo nights, and she was gone when he returned. He parked in the driveway, the wagon's license plates obscured by mud, and loaded his gear. A note with $50 for the inconvenience went on the kitchen table, waited by his house key. His note said a family crisis called him away unexpectedly. John spent the night in an outlying motel, collected his money from the safety deposit box in the morning, and John Leo Patrick McCarthy headed west. The transition had gone much more simply than he had anticipated. There remained one more essential detail to complete it. Over the next 3 days, he removed the hair from his head. There had been a choice: shave or do something more permanent. He chose the latter course, not an insurmountable task for a biochemist, although it proved painful and left a fine network of pink scars, tiny veins that he knew would fade in time. The mole on his left cheek vanished under an application of liquid nitrogen, leaving a scabbed sore that would in time become a puckered dimple. The change fascinated him. He examined it carefully in the bathroom mirror of a Spokane motel. The flashing neon of an adjoining hamburger stand cast a baleful, stroboscopic glare across the side of his face as the light flashed on the bathroom's drawn shade. He smiled. John Roe O'Neill, rather plump and with a rich mat of brown hair, a distinctive mole on his cheek, had become this bald, slender man with eyes of a burning intensity. "Hello, John Leo Patrick McCarthy," he whispered. 4 days later, the first Friday in October, he moved into a furnished rental house in the Ballard suburb of Seattle, Washington. He had a 1-year lease and only a bank with which to deal. The owners lived in Florida. The Ballard house suited his purpose perfectly. The ease with which he had found it struck him as an omen. The owners had painted it a muddy brown with white trim. It sat anonymously in a mishmash row of other houses equally anonymous. The houses had been built on a long, low embankment, some sporting rockeries, some steep lawns. Most of them possessed daylight basements and garages under the main floor. John's garage opened into the basement with ample room to unload the power wagon. The furniture was garage sale jumble, and the bed sagged. Old cooking smells permeated the house and persisted in the draperies. There was an odor of stale tobacco in the bathroom. He flushed the toilet and caught his reflection in the mirror over the sink. None of his old mildness had survived. This other was driven from within. He leaned close to the mirror and looked at the puckering scar where he had removed the mole. In that pitted void he sensed a final break with his past. The past of Mary, who had called the mole his beauty spot. He tried to remember the sensation of her kiss on that place. This memory, too, had gone. The shifting of his memories, the unchecked displacements, sent a shudder through him. He turned away from the mirror quickly. There were things to do. In the next few days he made essential changes in the house, translucent film over basement and garage windows to shield him from prying eyes, burglar alarms, a substantial stock of food. The fireproof box went into a bricked-over secret cache he built behind the furnace. Only then did he feel free to start setting up the purchase routine for the special equipment his project required. The thing that surprised him the most over the following weeks was the ease with which he acquired esoteric necessities. Telephone calls and money orders from anyone putting a doctor in front of his name appeared to be the only requirement. He had everything sent to warehouse and accommodation drops, using different names, always paying cash. While he was busy, memories remained tame and manageable. At night in bed, though, the shifting kaleidoscope in his mind often kept him awake. It was an odd thing, he thought, and not easily explained. John O'Neill had found it impossible to remember the fatal bomb's explosion. John McCarthy remembered it in detail. He remembered the newspaper clippings, O'Neill's screaming features in the photograph. But that person of the photo was gone. John McCarthy could remember him, though. He could recall the talks with police, the accounts of witnesses, the cadaverous figure of Father Devon, who had never corrected that initial mistake, believing that John had fallen into a mixed marriage. John McCarthy found he could put it all together. The sisters at the hospital, the doctors. He could remember his old self standing at the bank's window, the orange blast of the explosion. His memory replayed the scene at the slightest provocation. The little car, that brown elbow on the windowsill. There was Mary smiling and laughing as she hustled the twins across the street, the package clutched under her elbow. Odd, John thought, that they never found the package. Obviously, it had contained the sweaters for the children. The cost of them had shown up on a credit card bill, Mary's scrawled signature on the receipt. The entire incident at the Grafton Street corner assumed in time the nature of a movie. It was locked in a sequence that he could call up at will. The crush of people around Mary and the twins, her stopping beside that old Ford. And always the orange explosion peppered with shards of black. He found that he could control the flow of it, focus upon particular faces, mannerisms, gestures, and bits of personality in that macabre companionship. And always the orange explosion, the sound thumping in his skull. These were, he knew, John O'Neill memories, somehow removed from John McCarthy, insulated. It was like having a television screen in his mind with descriptive pictures and voices.
"Good God! What was that?"
the bank manager shouted. They were a historical record, accurate but failing to touch anything within John McCarthy except that fierce determination to visit horror upon the authors of John O'Neill's agony. As he grew accustomed to this play of memory, he found it could be expanded backward and forward. The punctual bomb had exploded during their first day in Dublin after an obligatory 3 days in a castle guesthouse near Shannon Airport. The 3 days had put heads and bodies into Ireland's time zone after the flight from the United States. "Now we have our Irish feet," Mary had said as they registered at the Sherborne in Dublin. John had awakened early that first morning in the city by the black pool. There had not been one whiff of premonition. Contrast, that was what it had been. He had begun the day with an exuberant feeling of health and happiness, all of which only amplified the later anguish. Tragedies of that dimension should be anticipated by omens, he told himself later. There should be warnings, ways to prepare. There had been nothing. He awakened beside Mary in one of the two bedrooms of their suite. Turning toward her, he found himself intensely aware of her loveliness. The tousled hair, the eyelashes brushing her cheeks, the soft rise and fall of her breasts as she breathed deeply in sleep. The O'Neill thought was clear and simple. Ah, the fortune of this marriage. There had been peripheral awareness of the twins sleeping in the adjoining bedroom, the sounds of morning traffic on the street outside, a smell of baking bread in the air. A sweet begod! The McCarthy grandfather would have been proud. "We'll go back some day, lad," the old man had often said. "We'll return in style." "We're here in style, Grandpa Jack. You didn't live to see it, but I hope you know about it." It had been a sad thing that Grandpa Jack never made it back to the old sod. Back was probably not the correct word, though, because he had been born on the ship to Halifax. All of this for 700 rifles. That had been the McCarthy family plaint during the poor times. John had never lost the memory of Grandpa Jack's voice regretting the flight from Ireland. It was a story told and retold until it could be called up in total by John O'Neill. The McCarthy silver, buried to keep it from piratical English tax collectors, had been dug up to finance the purchase of 700 rifles for a rising. In the aftermath of defeat, Grandpa Jack's father, a price on his head, had spirited the family to Halifax under an assumed name. They had not resumed the McCarthy name until they were safely into the United States, well away from the thieving British. In his Dublin hotel room, John O'Neill sat up quietly in the bed, aware then of how Mary's breathing changed as she started to waken. She cleared her throat, but her eyes remained closed. Mary O'Gara, of the Limerick O'Garas. She had loved Grandpa Jack. What a sweet old man. More Irish than the Irish. None could sing the Wearing of the Green with a more stirring voice. From your father's people, John Roe O'Neill, you're descended from the E'Neill. Ardri, high kings they were on the hill of Tara. The grandfather had begun the genealogical litany the same way every time. And from the McCarthys, well now, lad, we were kings once too. Never you forget it. Castle McCarthy was a mighty place, and strong men built it. The O'Neill grandfather had died when John was two. John's father, Kevin Patrick O'Neill, turning away from the Irishness, had sneered at Grandpa Jack's McCarthy stories. But John's young head had been filled with troubles and risings and an abiding hatred of the British. He had particularly enjoyed the stories of Hugh O'Neill's revolt and the rebellion of Owen Roe O'Neill. Roe O'Neill? That's part of my name, Grandpa.
Indeed, 'tis. And you'd be advised to live your life in a way that gives honour to such illustrious ancestors. Burn everything British except their coals.
How Grandpa Jack had laughed at that. In the Dublin hotel room bed, Mary spoke beside John.
We're really here.
Then,
I still miss Grandpa Jack.
I believe it was Tacitus who said there is a principle of human nature requiring us to hate those we have wronged. William Beckett, M.D. And even 100 copies of the first madman letter went out, and the following letters were more numerous. The first letters, all sent from an agency drop in Los Angeles, went to government officials, newscasters, editors, and to important scientists. Their message was clear. Quarantine the infected areas. To that end, some of the letters carried an additional page calling on scientist recipients to explain the gravity of the situation to their political leaders. Dr. William Ruckerman, past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, received one of the letters with the additional page. It arrived at his San Francisco home with the Monday morning mail, and he opened it over breakfast. He realized at once why he had been selected to receive this letter. His own DNA researches were not exactly secret in the scientific community. This letter had been written by someone on the inside, or close enough to the inside that the special nuances of Ruckerman's project were known to him. Ruckerman reread the references to back translation from the protein to determine the RNA, thence to the DNA transcription. That was ordinary enough, but the writer of this letter also made it clear he had used a computer to sort through the restriction fragments. That was a bit more esoteric, a bit more inside. What sent a chill up Ruckerman's spine was the reference to using stereoisomers in translating the RNA sequences in the protein molecules. Superimposition to determine the patterns. Those were the madman's words. Ruckerman suspected immediately that the man had used alkene polymerization for part of his breakdown series, conjugation and resonance. Yes, the man implied as much. The letter shows a full understanding of purification and subunit composition techniques, he said to his wife, who was reading over his shoulder. He knows. There was enough information to convince a knowledgeable reader, Ruckerman realized. This in itself said a great deal about the author. There had to be more to it, Ruckerman knew. The madman fell short of revealing key facts, but he led up to those facts with chilling accuracy. That, coupled to the threats, stirred Ruckerman to action. He thought carefully about how to handle this, then sent his wife to pack a suitcase, following her to the bedroom where he placed a call to the president's science advisor, Dr. James Ryan Sadler. Even then, Ruckerman was forced to press his way through a barrier of secretaries. Tell him it's Will Ruckerman, and it's important.
Could you tell me the nature of this important matter? The secretary asked, her voice sweetly insistent.
Ruckerman took two deep breaths to calm himself, staring at his reflection in the bedroom mirror. There were new lines in his angular face, and his hair definitely was going gray. His wife Louise looked up from the packing, but did not speak.
Listen,
"Whoever you are," Ruckerman said. "This is Dr. Ruckerman, past president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a close friend of Jim Sadler. I have important information that the President of the United States should know. If there's any need for you to know, I'm sure someone will tell you. Meanwhile, you patch me through to Jim."
"May I have your telephone number, sir?"
She was all business now. Ruckerman gave her the number and cradled the telephone. Louise, who had read the madman letter over his shoulder, asked,
"You think that's a real threat?"
"I do." He stood up and went to the bathroom. Returning, he stood beside the bedroom phone and tapped his fingers on the dresser top. They were taking ungodly long about it. He knew they would get through to Sadler, though. Jim had laughingly explained it once. "The presidency of the United States runs on communication. Not on facts, but on the intangible thing we like to call information, which is a kind of bargaining token exchanged at high levels. Carriers of this information always recognize the value of it. You'd be surprised at how many official reports begin with or include, 'We have information that...'" That's not the royal we, but the bureaucratic we. It means someone else can be blamed or share the blame if the information proves wrong. Ruckerman knew he had put on enough pressure that the White House communication system, a military operation, would find Sadler. The telephone rang. Sadler was at Camp David, a male operator informed him. The science advisor's voice sounded just a bit sleepy.
"Will, what's so damn important you have to..."
"I won't waste your time, Jim. I've received a letter that..."
"From someone calling himself the madman?"
"That's right. And I..."
"The FBI's on it, Will. Just another crank.
Jim, I don't think you'd be advised to treat this as a crank letter. His postscript should convince us of..."
"What postscript?"
"The additional page where he gives some of the details about..." "There's no postscript on our letter. I'll have an agent come around to pick it up."
"Damn it, Jim, will you listen to me? I've been part way down the path this guy describes. He's no amateur. Now I'm warning you to treat his threat as real. If I were in your shoes, I'd be counseling the president to take at least the first steps toward complying with..."
"Oh, come on, Will.
Do you have any idea of the political implications? He wants a quarantine. Then he wants us to send all Libyans in the U.S. back to Libya, all Irish back to Ireland, all English back to England. Everyone, including their diplomats. We can't just..."
"If we don't, he threatens to bring the U.S. into..." Ruckerman paused, then read from the letter. "The net of his revenge."
"I read that, and I don't give one bit of credence to..."
"You aren't listening, Jim.
I'm telling you, it's possible to do what this guy threatens."
"Are you serious?"
"I'm deadly serious."
The line went silent, and Ruckerman could hear faint crosstalk, the voices too low to make out the words. Sadler came back on.
"Will, if it were anyone else telling me this...
I mean, deadly new diseases for which there are no natural resistances, and... how the hell could he spread them? I can think of a dozen easy ways without even straining my imagination."
"Damn it. You're beginning to frighten me."
"Good. This letter scares the shit out of me."
"Will, I'll have to see that postscript before..."
"You won't act on my recommendation?"
"How can I be expected to go into the..."
"Jim, time is important. The president should be briefed immediately. The affected diplomats should be alerted. The military, the police in major cities, health officials, civil defense. This might cause a panic. You have the main body of his letter. He says he's already loosed this thing. That means quarantine. Damn it all, he says it plain enough. Let it run its course where I have loosed it. Remember that I can introduce malignancy wherever I choose. If you attempt to sterilize the infected areas by atomic means, I shall give my revenge the open run of every land on this globe. Read that part again, Jim, and in the light of my warning, you tell me what you should be doing right now. Will, if you're wrong, do you have any idea what the repercussions? And if you're wrong, you're asking me to take a lot on faith. Damn it, Jim, you're a scientist. You should know by now that... Then you tell me, Will, how a disease can be made sex-specific. Okay. At the present stage of my own project, which I'm convinced is far behind this madman... Well, I believe diseases can be tailored to many genetic variations. To white skin, for example. To the susceptibility to sickle cell anemia. But how could one person... I mean the cost... Peanuts. I've run a calculation on the required equipment. Less than $300,000, including the computer. A basement lab somewhere? Ruckerman fell silent. Presently, Sadler said, I'll want that list of equipment. The suppliers should be able to... I'll read it off to you in a minute. But I think it'll be too late even if we locate his lab. You really think... I think he's done it. This letter. He lays out the essentials, and there's not a mistake in it. I think Ireland, Great Britain, and Libya, and probably the rest of us, are in for one terrible time. I don't see how we can totally contain such a thing. But for openers, we'd better set about quarantining those areas, for our own safety, if not for other reasons. What other reasons? This madman is still running around loose. We don't want him mad at us. Will, he says not a human female will survive in those three nations. I mean, really? How can you... I'll give you a more complete analysis later. Right now, I'm begging you to take the necessary first steps. The president should be on that hotline to Moscow and to the other major capitals. He should... Will, I believe I'd better send a plane for you. I don't want to take this to the president by myself. If we have to convince him, well, he knows your reputation, and if you... Louise already has packed my bag. And Jim, one of the first things to do is to get as many young women as possible into that Denver hideaway the military is so proud of. Women, got that? And only enough men to run the technical end of a survival plan. Ruckerman let this sink in. Many women, few men, just the opposite of what might occur outside such a sanctuary. He continued, The Russians and the other world leaders ought to be advised to take similar action. That'll go a long way toward convincing them of our sincerity. We don't want the Russians thinking this is some diabolical capitalist plot. God knows they're paranoid enough as it is. I think we should leave high-level diplomatic decisions to the experts, Will. You just get your ass back here with enough evidence to convince me you're right. Ruckerman replaced the phone in its cradle and looked across the bedroom at his wife. He's going to wait for you, she said. Ruckerman slammed his fist against the dresser top, making the telephone bounce. Louise, you take the car. Pack only necessities. Buy as much food as you can safely store and get up to our place at Glen Ellen. Take the guns. I'll be in touch. I obey the master of death. Part of an Ulster secret society oath. Ackle Island, south of Black Sod Bay in County Mayo, stood out against a storm-blown Atlantic morning in which the Irish country folk already were active, preparing for the first flow of tourists, getting the hay planted, cutting sods and piling them to dry, generally going about the everyday activities of their lives. The island was a play of many greens interspersed with spots of black rock and flecks of white where the residents had raised their buildings. Ackle, split from the main body of Ireland by the retreat of the last glacier, held few trees. The steep slopes of its hills were lined with firs growing along the sod-cutter's furrows, and the first marsh violets were beginning to show themselves, competing with stone brambles and saxifrage and the omnipresent heather. Here and there, pennywort had begun to poke its way out of the rocks. A
A granite ruin lay crumbled into the weeds atop the hill where the road from Mulrainey curved around before dropping down to the bridge across to the island. Its lancet arches and crenellated battlements had collapsed into low mounds covered by a few stunted ivy plants and lichen. The scabbed rock surfaces gave not a hint of the slitted windows where defenders had failed to repel Cromwell. Two polite young soldiers with Irish harp insignia at their shoulders stood at the barricade that blocked the bridge to the island. They already had turned back two tourist autos that had entered the road to the island before the barriers had been raised farther back at Mulrainey. The soldiers had apologized for the inconvenience and suggested the tourists go instead to Balmullet, a beautiful place where the old ways may still be seen. To all questions, the soldiers responded, "We're not at liberty to say, but it's sure to be only temporary." Three goods lorries traveling tandem with supplies for the island stores were harder to placate. "We're very sorry, lads, but it's none of our doing. I agree you should have been warned, but it's no use complaining. Orders is orders. This road is closed." Four armored cars with a major in charge pulled up as the soldiers were arguing with the lorry drivers. The major and a sergeant jumped out, the sergeant with an automatic rifle held at the ready. The major, a thin, stony-eyed man with bush-gray hair under a forage cap, accepted the salutes of the two soldiers, then turned to the lorry drivers.
"Back the way you came, lads. No more arguing."
One of the drivers started to speak, but the major cut him short.
"Turn those lorries around and get out of here, or one of my men will drive them into the water and we'll take you back under guard."
Muttering, the drivers climbed into their cabs, backed the lorries into the car park beside the bridge, and headed up the road to Mulrainey. The major stepped over to his radio man in one of the armored cars and said,
"Alert Mulrainey to keep those lads moving out."
Returning to the two soldiers at the bridge barricade, he swiveled slowly, studying his surroundings, taking in the high hill above Pulrani and the higher crown of Carran beyond. There was Alice's Harbour Inn beside the car park, the barricade, the white buildings across the bridge on the island, a group of men standing there, heads close together, talking intently. Presently, the major returned to his radio man and inquired,
"Have the patrol boats taken up position at the Bull's Mouth and Acklebeg?"
The radio man, a pimply young man with nervous manners, bent over his microphone and in a moment said,
"They're in place, sir, and one's coming down from the Bull's Mouth to pick up the islanders' small boats."
"Good," the major said.
"We don't want any boats left over there to tempt them into leaving."
He sighed.
"Damned stupid mess."
He strolled back to the armored cars then and told the sergeant,
"Better get the men deployed. No one enters or leaves except the medics, of course, and they'll be coming by helicopter."
The major went into Alice's then, and he could be heard inquiring if there was any coffee. Some 2 kilometers back up the road toward Mulrainey, 3 squads of soldiers under a lieutenant finished setting up a row of tents in the lee of the hill that commanded the narrow, salty moat separating Ackle from Ireland proper. A sandbag emplacement with 2 machine guns had already been installed on the slope above the tents. When the tents were up, the lieutenant instructed a corporal,
"Take your squad and notify all the locals there to stay close to home. No wandering about and no going over to the island. Tell them it's a quarantine and nothing more."
On Carran Hill's 526-meter peak, about 4 kilometers south of this position, more soldiers had piled sandbags onto a section of an old castle ruin, forming a shelter for 2 20-millimeter cannon and 4 mortars. It began to rain while they were positioning the mortars. They spread shelter halves over the weapons, then huddled in their waterproofs while a colonel, standing slightly below them, peered through binoculars at Ackle.
"A lot of moving around over there," the colonel said.
"I'll be happier when we have their small boats and the water closed to them."
One of the soldiers above him ventured,
"Colonel, is it a bad sickness they have over there?"
"So I've been told," the colonel said.
He lowered his glasses, scanned the emplacement, fixing his gaze finally on a tall sergeant who stood somewhat apart.
"Get some shelters up, sergeant. And you're to look sharp. Only the medics are to enter that place, and no one's to leave. We'll not let so much as a fox through, sir."
Turning away, the colonel took long-legged strides down the slope to a jeep waiting on the narrow track below the emplacement. As one, the soldiers he had left behind looked across at Akko, the island of the eagles, which no longer were there. It was a brooding landscape in the rain, a speckling of white rocks and buildings against the greens. The few roads cut gray ledges around the hills, and the ocean was a deeper gray below. Sleevemore and Caron thrust almost into the clouds toward Acklehead's outer cliffs. It was a place turned in upon itself, and the men looking across at the island could feel the simmering mood of the land. Generations of men and women had brooded passionately there on the wrongs done to Ireland. No Irishman could fail to sense that thing smouldering there, the sullen hopes of all those who had perished for the Irish dream.
"It'll be a scurrying around time for the priests," the sergeant said. Then, "Now, men, you heard the colonel. Shouldn't we be raising some shelters?"
Far below this position, and at the Ackle end of the bridge, where the town street became the high road to the island's interior, Mulvaney's saloon bar had begun to collect a crowd of local residents and a few tourists. They hunched against the rain, hurrying from cars and bicycles into the bar's steamy interior with its thick smells of wet wool and beer. Mulvaney's, a two-story whitewashed building with slate roof and three massive chimneys, was one of the island's natural assembly points. It was soon crowded with men talking too loudly, their faces angry, their gestures abrupt and latent with violence. A small Garda patrol car pulled up outside, bringing a lull in the conversations as the word of it was spread through the bar. Dennis Flynn, the local Garda, emerged from the car. Flynn, a small blonde man with light blue eyes and a boyish face, appeared pale and trembling. Way was made for him as he entered the bar, pressed through the crowd to the western end, and climbed onto a chair. In the expectant silence, Flynn's voice was a thin tenor, which broke in unexpected places.
"We've been quarantined," he said. "They're sending medical teams by helicopter. No one is to enter or leave the island except the medical people and officials."
In the sudden babble of shouted questions, Flynn raised his voice to demand silence, then,
"We'll just have to be patient. Everything's being done that can be done."
Mulvaney, a soft giant of a man with a bald head as shiny as his polished bar, thrust his way through the crowd to stand below Flynn. Hooking a thumb over his shoulder, Mulvaney said,
"It's my Molly sick back there, and only the one doctor. I want to know what it is."
"I'm only the Garda," Flynn said.
"It's the medical men will have to answer that."
Mulvaney glanced out the windows beyond Flynn, looking toward Knockmore and the village of Drogheda, which lay hidden beyond the hills in the hollow that protected it from the worst of the Atlantic gales. His brother Francis had called from there not 10 minutes ago to report another death, his voice full of the tears as he spoke. Turning a hard stare up at Flynn, Mulvaney said,
"Your women folk are living safe beyond Mulrainey. You can take the official view. But it's my sister-in-law, Shanine, died this morning."
A man back in the press of people shouted,
"And my Katie has the sickness. We want answers, Flynn, and we want them now." "I've told you what I know," Flynn said. "That's all I can do."
"What's this about officials coming?" Mulvaney demanded.
"From the health office in Dublin."
"Why do they have soldiers barring our way?" someone else demanded.
"They've even guns up on Caron."
"There's no need to create a panic," Flynn said.
"But it's a serious matter." "Then why do we not hear it on the wireless?" Mulvaney asked. "Haven't I said we don't want a panic?" "It's the plague, isn't it?" Mulvaney asked.
An abrupt silence settled over the room. A small, dark man with pinched features, standing at Flynn's right, cleared his throat.
"There's our own boats," the man said. "There'll be none of that, Martin," Flynn snapped, glaring down at the speaker. "The Navy'll be here in a few minutes to collect your boats. My orders are to prevent your leaving Ackle.
using what force necessary.
His voice hoarse, Mulvaney asked,
Are all of our womenfolk to die then? 19 dead since yesterday, and only the women and girls. Why is that, Dennis?
The doctors will find the answer, Flynn said. He jumped down off the chair, steadying himself against Mulvaney, but not looking the man in the eye.
Flynn's own superintendent had voiced that same fear less than an hour earlier, speaking with gentle firmness over the telephone.
If all the women die there, it could be very bad, Dennis. And there's talk it was done deliberately. You're not to speak of that now.
Deliberate?
By the Ulstermen? Or the British? I'll not discuss it, Dennis. I speak only to impress you with the gravity of our situation. You there inside the quarantine will be alone for a bit to represent authority. We depend on you.
Will I get no help, then?
Some soldiers are being asked to volunteer, but they'll not be along until the afternoon.
I didn't volunteer, sir.
But you swore an oath to do your duty, and that's what I'm asking of you now.
As he pressed his way out of Mulvaney's, ignoring the questions still being shouted at him, Flynn recalled that telephone conversation. There had been more orders and things he must do now. The rain had turned to a light mist as he emerged from the bar. He got into his car, not looking at the angry faces peering at him from Mulvaney's. Starting the motor, he turned around and drove slowly down to the concrete apron overlooking Ackle Sound and the fish boats anchored there. He could see a fast patrol boat spreading a wide bow wave as it sped down from the Bull's Mouth. It appeared to be no more than 5 minutes away, for which he was thankful. He parked on the concrete and took his shotgun from its rack, feeling strange with the weapon in his hands. The superintendent had been firm with his instructions.
"I want you on armed watch, Dennis, until they pick up those small boats. I want it understood that you'll use your weapon if necessary."
Flynn stared bleakly across the water at the approaching patrol boat. Seabirds were wheeling and calling over the strand. He inhaled the familiar salt odors, the smell of the seaweeds, and the pungency of fish. How many times had he looked on this scene and never thought it strange, Flynn wondered. Now, though, the differences sent a shuddering through his thin body. The thing he had wanted to say back at Mulvaney's, the thing that had filled his throat with sourness, stood uppermost in his mind. But his superintendent had been adamant on the need for secrecy.
A great many women are sure to die, perhaps all on the island. We count on you to keep the peace until help arrives. There must be no panic, no mobs. You must be firm in keeping order.
I should have told them, Flynn muttered to himself. They should be bringing in the priests. It's sure nothing else will help them now.
He stared out at the moored fish boats, feeling a deep loneliness and a sense of inadequacy.
Lord, help us now, in the hour of our need, he whispered.